Key factors in any economy: jobs, growth, wages, of course. Also, debt, and the global enterprise. Today, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 22nd of December. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We begin today in Italy, but move very quickly through Greece, the European Union, and the rest of the global economy. It goes like this. The Italian parliament approved a $21 billion bank bailout this week. Greece has just had its debt relief suspended by its European creditors. Nearly a decade on from the start of the financial crisis, debt is arguably the global economic indicator. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going.
Global debt hit $202 trillion this year, according to McKinsey Global Institute. Big numbers like that can be tough to grasp, but the point is it's a jump of more than 50% from pre-crisis levels. Let's start with Europe, which is dominating the news this week. Years of austerity programs and tighter banking regulations have had some impact, says Nicholas Verone, visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He is hopeful, but also critical of the pace of change.
The sad truth is that Europe moves very slowly, and it has waited until essentially 2012, which was sort of a watershed year in the treatment of the Eurozone crisis.
Beyond Europe, China's debt-to-GDP ratio keeps rising. Japan, too, is in debt, and its government has just announced record spending for next year. And some emerging market countries are having problems because of falling commodity prices. What to do? Vanguard Global Debt Strategist Jonathan Lemko.
The first remedy for any global debt problem, of course, is economic growth.
Easier said than done. Mauro Guillen at the Wharton School thinks too much growth is coming about the wrong way.
Well, I think the biggest issue is that we have become very dependent on debt as a source of growth, meaning government debt, household debt.
If we can get more growth from productivity gains shared by companies and workers, that'll be more sustainable, he believes. Here in the U.S., the economy is growing nicely, but we shouldn't be smug. Verone points to the possible impact of promised tax cuts and infrastructure spending.
There is a new possibility with the Trump administration of rapid buildup of federal government debt. This could create new forms of risks that haven't been fully factored in yet.
Of course, it's early and the specifics of the administration's tax and spending plans are yet to come. And globally, as far as debt goes, the risks remain. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We learned this morning from the good people at the Department of Commerce that the economy grew at an annual rate of 3.5% July through September, a healthy clip and up solidly from the beginning of the year. We've got one more full quarter of the Obama economy, and then come January 20th, a whole new set of economic realities. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at healthy gross domestic product growth and the president-elect's tariff plans.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump said he would put a 45% tariff or tax on imports from China and also tax Mexican imports. Economist Kathy Busjancic is with Oxford Economics. She's crunched the numbers to see how those tariffs would affect our economy. She found the tariffs would nudge down the economy just a bit.
It would actually, at the end of 4 years, lower the level of GDP growth by 1.6%.
Why? The U.S. tariffs would make all the cheap imports lining the shelves of Walmart and Target stores more expensive. Consumers wouldn't buy as much, and they're a big driver of our economy. Amit Khandelwal teaches emerging markets at Columbia Business School. He says lower-income consumers would be hit hardest by the higher prices for imports.
Lower-income individuals tend to spend more of their income on goods that cross borders. So you can think about going to Walmart, while richer individuals tend to spend more on services like restaurants and movie tickets and so forth.
And here's another thing. If we raise tariffs on products from other countries, they'll probably retaliate and raise tariffs on things we export to them, making them more expensive. Kendall says U.S. companies with factories in other countries would also suffer. He says parts used in a U.S.-owned factory in, say, China can come from both countries.
And those components might go to Japan and then go from Japan back to the United States and then to China.
And the U.S. factory would have to pay a tariff each time a part crossed the border, cutting into its bottom line and eventually the overall U.S. economy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Dow 20K? Forget about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. There was some maneuvering at the United Nations Security Council today, a planned debate on a resolution and then the withdrawal of that resolution that would have condemned the continued construction of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The really interesting thing, apart from the delicate politics of that region, was the public pressure that President-elect Trump put on the White House to veto that resolution were it to come to a vote. It came. The pressure did via Twitter, of course. William Booth is the Jerusalem bureau chief of the Washington Post. We've called him to talk about the changes that are coming to the American relationship with Israel. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Kai.
Is it possible that with what seems to be a changing tenor of the political relationship with Israel under a Trump administration, there might be a new economic relationship as well?
The short answer to this is the U.S.-Israel relationship on trade and on tech and on defense development stuff couldn't be better under President Obama, even though there were some complaints about him in other regards.
You know, that's so interesting because this past fall, when there was the big foreign aid deal done and President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu were, if not openly hostile, they were. It was clear that the two sides were not happy with each other. One got a very different impression.
Yeah, those two cats did not get along for reasons. But as they tussled in the press and probably a little bit behind closed doors, I mean, the Israeli Defense Forces and the Pentagon, their relationship was just as tight as could be. Hmm. In fact, at the end of the day, they signed this deal for $38 billion over 10 years. No other country gets this sort of largesse from the U.S. taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And just a week ago, I was down in the southern deserts of Israel waiting for two F-35 airplanes to land. And Israel is the first country outside of the United States to get the Lockheed Martin F-35. I mean, whether that's a curse or a blessing, everyone thinks it's a blessing here.
Do you suppose after January the 20th then that American investment in Israel might increase, that the foreign aid budget, which is like $3.1 billion for the coming year, might increase? Might we actually see tangible things?
It's interesting with Trump because we don't know. Trump might give the Israelis less money. I mean, he's locked in to giving them $38 billion over 10 years, but he could fiddle with that. Trump is often told countries that are well-to-do, like Japan and maybe Israel, it's a very developed country, you know, pay more of your own way. But in terms of like business to business and anything that Trump could do, his new secretaries can do to improve the business climate, I imagine they would probably do, and the Israelis would suck that up.
There are few areas in the world and issues more intractable than the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Mr. Trump, as he has said many times, will bring his business acumen to bear in his administration. How do you think that plays out in as multifaceted a dispute as the Middle East?
That's just a fantastic question, and that's just the one that keeps me on the edge of my seat watching this story develop. There's a lot of people who would say that Donald Trump wasn't serious when he asserts that he is the ultimate deal maker and he will make an Israeli-Palestinian deal. I would only say that the U.S. under Republicans and Democrats before him have had no luck striking this deal since the Oslo Accords in the early 90s. Could Trump's out-of-the-box thinking cajole, scare, encourage, make everyone come back to the table and settle this once and for all? Hmm. Yeah, why not? I mean, the cynic would say no, right? So he's brought on a very super pro-Israeli guy for his choice for ambassador. This guy doesn't really believe in two states, David Friedman. But David Friedman works for Donald Trump. Anything's possible. I'm really looking to see. Hmm. Going from a diplomatic solution here to like a businessman solution, like your question was. I mean, that's hitting the nail on the head.
William Booth is the Washington Post's bureau chief in Jerusalem. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
The Trump administration is going to have a different set of economic and environmental policies than the Obama White House. That much is clear in the appointments the president-elect has made and the policies he's proposing. The federal government is going to be pulling back from attempts to counter a warming planet. Some parts of the government, though, farther down the chain of command, remain committed to dealing with climate change. They pretty much have to be to stay afloat. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
Naval Base Ventura County at Point Magoo sits on the Pacific coast about an hour and a half above Los Angeles. It is not a great place to conduct a radio interview.
It is an airfield after all.
Valerie Vartanian is a natural resources manager for the Navy. There are pretty extensive natural resources here. About half of the base's 7 square miles is salt marsh. Lots of animals hang out here.
It's a seal.
These days, though, a lot of Vartanian's work is about protecting the base from nature as the ocean level rises.
The reality is we're seeing more impacts from storms, we're seeing more flooding, and so we have to look at our areas that are vulnerable and try to be creative and clever about how we're going to protect our infrastructures.
It's logical that a Navy base be situated on the water. A group of us visit a stretch of pristine beach. Untouched sand is a rare find in Southern California. Vartanian says in this case, it's getting rarer.
We've lost about 400 feet of beach since the 1940s.
Sand naturally erodes from beaches. It also naturally refills them. Construction further up the chain has interrupted most of that natural flow.
So buildings that were quite a bit away from the beach, from the waves, are now very close. So for instance, this little building that you see off to the side here, which is right next to the road, which seems like it's awfully close, and why would you put it so close to the beach? Well, there was 400 feet more beach separating it from the waves.
That little building houses a lot of electronics for one of the runways.
So we would rather not have that go underwater. And then if you look out, where would you move it to? You can see that anywhere that we would put it inland means taking out more of the wetlands. So we're caught between a wetland and an ocean.
The building has already flooded. Increasingly, so have other buildings and roads. Diane Leger-Jump directs the Facilities Management Division at the base. She says the base will redesign using a combination of retiring some buildings, expanding wetlands and dunes, and installing hard protections like seawalls where necessary.
So those are the things that we're going to look at very closely and try to make those wise decisions, because they are expensive decisions and we want to make the right decisions. So have the right facilities in the right place.
For help, they've partnered with the Nature Conservancy. Lily Verdone is the Coastal Project Director for the Nature Conservancy in California.
This is the first public-private partnership to address climate adaptation on a Department of Defense land.
The Nature Conservancy has reduced the project's costs because it's already got a lot of research and mapping resources in-house. Verdone says the Navy also stands to save by incorporating as many soft solutions as possible.
We've been finding that it's, in the long term, a lot cheaper where you can to rely on nature, looking at how we can maintain the beaches, maintain our floodplains, maintain sand dunes, to use as that natural defense.
The adaptation partnership was signed in 2016. Teresa Miller, a spokeswoman for the base, says it came about after the Department of Defense released its climate change adaptation roadmap.
It's based on, you know, DoD recognition in 2014 of climate change and how important it is to prepare for what we know is an eventuality and to protect our infrastructure for sure.
The program could serve as a pilot for other bases facing rising waters. Even as other pilots, the ones in the sky, need to stay war ready, it's the waters they train over that are proving the more immediate threat. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So it was the first time that a computer could be might be said to have come up with its own concept.
Nah, nothing to worry about there. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 23 points today, about a 10%, 19,918 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 24 points, about 0.4%, 54.47. The S&P 500 dropped 4 points, a 10% lower, 22.60. Retailers reel today. Bed Bath & Beyond slipped 9.1% after posting weaker-than-expected sales. Target off 4.4%. Dollar Tree down 5.2%. In tech, software company Red Hat shed 13.8%. Third-quarter revenue did not meet analyst expectations. Company's also going to lose its chief financial officer next month. Facebook down 1.3%. Twitter off about 3.9%. Israel's Teva Pharmaceutical Industries moved up 2 3/10% today. The world's biggest generic drug maker agreed to settle an investigation into possible bribes paid to foreign governments. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.55%. You're listening to Marketplace. We may not know what next year is going to bring, but your listener support of Marketplace guarantees we'll all be better informed and better prepared. Make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you, like me, are scrambling present-wise as the deadline grows inexorably closer, you might, like me, have had to roll the dice on a gift or two. Thankfully, the place you went to has a pretty good return policy, right? Or does it? That's the question in today's installment of our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
How exactly do stores come up with their return policies? Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one for us.
I'm at a Target in downtown Los Angeles trying to get to the bottom of this one. That's where I run into Lauren Ireland, who just got done exchanging a gift at the return counter. I ask her if a store's return policy matters to her.
Yeah. I won't buy it if I know I can't return it.
Target's return policy is posted clearly behind the return cashier. It says the store will do everything it can to ensure customer satisfaction, and that most unopened items returned within 90 days in new condition will receive a refund or exchange. But that's Target's policy. Angela Hausman is a marketing professor at George Washington University.
They don't have to do anything when the product is not defective based on manufacturing. Businesses do this because of the goodwill that it generates with customers.
Goodwill and loyalty. In such a competitive market, you can buy that stocking stuffer anywhere, even order it online and have it shipped to your house nowadays. And regulators aren't telling retailers they have to do this.
I think the biggest thing for consumers to understand is that there really are no legal protections for them. And if they have a very stringent return policy, you're just out of luck.
Returns cost the retailer a lot of money. If you buy a sweater at Target and return it, Target is going to try to return that sweater to the manufacturer. But there's no guarantee the manufacturer will give the retailer a refund. Joe Colangelo is president of Consumers Research. He says this becomes a bigger issue when customers take advantage of a return policy.
Fraudulent returns account for about 4% of all holiday returns. Just holiday sales alone, there's going to be $2.2 billion in fraudulent returns.
Some people call it renting. You need a drill for a day, but you don't really need a drill all the time. So you go to a store with a liberal return policy, use the drill for a day, and then take it back. All right, so is there anything a business can do to make sure people aren't taking advantage of that return policies they establish?
People's behavior is very, very difficult to change. There are a number of customers who are never going to take advantage of a return policy because they feel that it's morally, you know, wrong. And then there are some people that no matter how strict you make it, they're going to find the loophole that allows them to get a little extra.
All right, now here's the crazy part. Believe it or not, a liberal return policy might lead to fewer returns. Stacy Wood teaches management at North Carolina State University. She's done research on this and says it's a psychological thing.
So here's what happens. Here's the mechanism. When consumers see a liberal return policy, it's a signal to them, a cue that the retailer is standing behind their products. What happens is that there's this tricky little psychological bias that we all fall prey to, which is called confirmatory bias. And what happens is that we tend to view evidence in a way that confirms our prior expectations.
So for many customers, a liberal return policy makes them think they're shopping at a good store. Maybe that's why L.L. Bean is willing to take back those 15-year-old cross-country skis, no questions asked. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai, has said he wants that company to be AI first. That is, artificial intelligence as a driving force. It's fair to ask, then, what does that mean exactly? The question is answered in a piece in the New York Times Magazine by Gideon Lewis Krause. It's called The Great AI Awakening. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Kai.
I think we got to follow the outlines, the contour of your piece here, and first talk about how folks noticed what Google was doing with artificial intelligence, and talk about Google Translate a little bit.
Over the last 9 months, a team at Google called Google Brain had set out to completely gut renovate this existing product, Google Translate, that is used by 500 million people a month. But they didn't tell anyone they were going to do it. And so in Japan, a professor of computer science at the University of Tokyo, who works on human augmentation research, tweeted that he had noticed that Google Translate had all of a sudden gotten a lot better, that instead of being kind of a word salad from Japanese into English and vice versa, that all of a sudden it seemed to be producing, you know, obviously not human-level translations, but something considerably better. And it turned out that this was because of this renovation of the product that Google had just completed.
They did it, Google did, by, as you said, a gut renovation of the innards of Translate. And it's all about neural networks and how Google figured out how to make them better. Is that a fair summary?
So the previous product behind Translate had been running for about 10 years, and it used statistical machine translation techniques that had been around for about 30 years. And
which is what? That's like substitute this word for that word and do it very formulaically.
More or less, yeah. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but that's basically it.
Yeah.
And about a year ago, the team on the Google Brain side that works on these things called neural networks had said, hey, we think that there's a way that we can totally revamp this. And instead, they could train it kind of from the ground up, the way that a person might learn a foreign language by just being dumped overseas and expected to start talking. That it was almost like an immersion kind of education for the machine.
Do me a favor and tell me about the cat picture, because that to me was the best example in this piece of what these machines are learning how to do.
Well, in 2012, Google Brain, which was then part of the secretive X Labs at the company, had released a paper that showed that they could give millions and millions of still images from YouTube to a network that had never been provided the definition of, you know, any human category. Once it was trained, they found that it had essentially invented for itself the concept of a cat. So it was the first time that a computer might be said to have come up with its own concept.
There are those who will hear this interview who are going to go, oh, my God, the robots are coming alive.
It's true. There are. But one of the ideas behind this piece was there's been so much long-term futuristic speculation about AI and about artificial superintelligence and about computers that are going to take over everything with their own will. And what we really wanted to do with this piece was to say, well, what exactly is going on there? How does this stuff work technologically? How can we keep, instead of racing forward to futuristic sci-fi scenarios, how can we actually keep this grounded in how the technology works and what it can actually do and what it can't do?
Right. And this gets us back to the cat picture, because a one-year-old human being can recognize a cat. That's the deal.
Right. Yes, right. That is the deal.
Right.
And the hope is that then it would evolve organically from there.
Right. So if Google and other companies now, and you talk about in this piece, right, Microsoft and all the other big names, if they are becoming AI companies, what does that mean for, you know, my refrigerator that's hooked to the internet and all of these, you know, Alexa and Siri and Google Home and all those devices?
The real answer is that nobody actually knows, and that one of the things that I found so interesting about talking to these engineers is that, as one of them said to me, look, you know, I'm an expert in this field, and I can maybe make some guesses about what this will look like 6 months or a year down the line, but as far as 5 or 10 years down the line, really your guess is as good as mine. The upshot is more that with these techniques, instead of focusing on the obvious kind of repetitive drudgery tasks that we have long associated with the march of automation, that these techniques allow machines to do things that we never would have really thought of as the province of machines. So translation was a really great example for this.
Right. Gideon Lewis Krause writes for the New York Times Magazine. His most recent piece is called The Great AI Awakening. It's a good one. Really totally interesting stuff. Gideon, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, a tale of two stock ticker symbols. Ticker number one, WTW, Weight Watchers International, shares up 5.3% today. Why, I hear you asking? Well, because company spokesperson and investor Oprah Winfrey said in a new ad this morning that she has lost 40 pounds. Ticker number two, URRE, Uranium Resources Incorporated. It's a uranium mining company. Shares ended today 31% higher, and I should say here it's a penny stock, so take that into account. But still, the proximate cause of the spike, and if you check the chart, it corresponds virtually to the minute, was this tweet from Donald Trump, quote, "The United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes," end of quote, capitalism. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 23 points today, 0.1%. The NASDAQ off 24 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 down 4 points, 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.